has been redeployed. A TikTok clip of Tamimi from 2012 when she was 11 falsely claiming that she is a Ukrainian girl standing up to a Russian soldier has been shared 12 million times. Back home, on the occupied West Bank, Tamimi was sent to jail for 8 months amidst boredom and indifference from the West. Reinvented as a member of the Ukrainian resistance to Russian oppression, it's another story altogether. As Chris Doyle, director of the Council for Anglo-Arab Understanding, said, Palestinians notice in the case of Russia, the world has rushed to impose sanctions, kick them out of cultural events, and to divest in the face of occupation. But when Palestinians call for boycott and divestment in the face of Israeli occupation, they are labeled anti-Semitic to the extent that the British government is trying to criminalize it. Or let's call it out for what it is, the blatant racism of the West. It is a delight that the United States, Britain, and Europe have rediscovered the importance of international law. The test now is to ensure that it is applied consistently across the globe. Midstream.
Despite constant non-stop air raids, which have counted up to almost 300,000 since the start of the war against Yemen in 2015, there were no new targets that the Saudi-led coalition of aggression could further add to its military targets. Hence, the Saudi-led coalition began targeting civilian facilities, specifically the communications sector in Yemen. In the first week of February, the spokesman of the Saudi-led coalition of aggression, Turki al-Maliki, announced the intention to target civilian sites used in what he referred to as military purposes. Soon enough, Riyadh launched a series of attacks on the Yemeni capital, targeting areas previously bombed with hundreds of raids, such as Ad-Daylami Bays, Al-Hafa areas, Attan, and At-Ta'an. As the results of the bombing were nihilistic, the coalition announced its intention to carry out air operations in Sana'a, which would include civilian sites that the coalition deemed are being used militarily. At dawn on Monday, the 14th of February, civil state institutions were included in the list of its new targets, calling on civilians to evacuate ministries and public institutions immediately. As usual, the Yemeni communications sector was amongst the first targets of the new aggression, although it is protected under international law as civilian facilities. Yemen's Ministry of Communications in Sana'a then announced that the Public Communications Corporation in Al-Jarf neighborhood had been subjected to a series of raids, two of which led to the complete destruction of the headquarters of the National Company for International Communications, Tele Yemen. The ministry confirmed that the Yemeni telecommunications sector is a service sector that has nothing to do with the conflict, reiterating its warning that this attack might result in the complete interruption of telecommunications and internet services for citizens in all governorates. Despite the destruction that the raids had on the Tele Yemen company, which led to a complete interruption of international communications between Yemen and the rest of the world, air raids resumed the evening on the same day. The targets this time were the company's devices related to the satellite internet, in addition to other devices and equipment, in an attempt to cut off internet services from all regions of Yemen. According to Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar, the government of outgoing President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi had received Emirati promises to operate the international gateway for communications from the city of Aden just days after the coalition targeted the internet gateway in Hudaydah governorate last month with a series of raids that disrupted services. The internet in Yemen was completely out for 5 days before the General Corporation for International Communications was able to restore services and repair the damage. This places what the coalition is doing within the framework of the systematic destruction of the infrastructure of the Yemeni state, which Riyadh and Abu Dhabi began more than 7 years ago. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Last week, the spokesman for the Saudi-led coalition Turki al-Maliki announced the intention to target civilian sites under the false pretext of being used for military purposes. Riyadh hastened to escalate its crimes against Yemen by launching a series of attacks on the Yemeni capital, targeting areas previously bombed with hundreds of raids. Saudi jets began pounding civil state institutions as part of the list of its new targets, calling on civilians to evacuate ministries and public institutions immediately. Now, this time, the Yemeni communications sector was the first target of the new aggression, although it is protected under international law as a civilian facility. The Ministry of Communications in Sana'a announced that the Public Communications Corporation had been subjected to a series of raids, two of which led to the complete destruction of the headquarters of the National Company for International Communications, Tele Yemen. To discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is engineer Nizar Al-Muayyad, head of the IT department at Sabafone Yemen. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Nizar. Now, the Yemeni communications sector was the first target of the new aggression by the Saudi-led coalition, although it is protected, as we said, by international law because it's considered as a civilian facility and a civilian institution. But it was completely destroyed. It was not only targeted, it was completely destroyed by the raid. And we're talking about the National Company for International Communications, Tele Yemen, in the capital, Sana'a. From your position there, as a manager of IT at Sabafone Yemen, are there any telecommunication services left for the Yemeni public to use?
Targeting Tele Yemen headquarter was not the first strike for telecom sector in Yemen. This sector was targeted since day one, from 2015 till today, either by hitting space stations or backbones links among cities. Aggression has successfully made physical siege by blocking airports and seaports. And now they are trying to make cyber siege by targeting telecom institutions in Yemen. If this continues, even the basic services like voice, short messages will even be suspended. Aggression media once declared clearly that the aim of such raid is to isolate communication among cities in Yemen. This will add up crimes over the current crimes for this aggression. Tele Yemen is the main international gateway of Yemen. When the aggression targeted Tele Yemen headquarters in Hudaydah this January, Yemen went offline. A whole country went offline for 5 days. You can imagine how many businesses, services, transactions, correspondences, platforms were suspended, and figure out the total loss for a country with this fragile economy due to this war. Not only this, the late strike for Tele Yemen headquarters in Sana'a led to a suspension of international roaming and international SMSs for all operators in Yemen, because Tele Yemen is the gateway. It was ironic that this strike happened after one day of a demonstration from a group of communication staff. They were in front of UN headquarters asking UN to neutralize communication. And that was the reply of the aggression.
Well, Mr. Nizar, despite its realization that the air raids it is pounding on Yemen, which have approached up until now 300,000 since the start of the war in 2015 on the people of Yemen, They are no longer feasible. Saudi Arabia already knows this, and the Saudi-led coalition has recently intensified its targeting of Yemeni civilian facilities, especially the communication sector, as you just told us, once in Hodeidah, several times in Sana'a, in other governorates of Yemen as well. In what appears to be a prelude to seizing the sector and maybe transferring it elsewhere from the capital towards Aden, through a Yemeni front represented by the ousted government of Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. What is your take on that approach?
They have tried to seize this sector before. I remember in 2019, and they announced it in all medias, that Tel Yaman headquarters was moved to Aden. Same thing happened to Sabafun in 2020, but they failed to apply that practically for many reasons. First one, although they have invested a lot, they were not equipped enough, and they don't have the technical readiness, they don't have the manpower to do so. Second thing, the population density is higher in the north, in the areas that are ruled by Sana'a government. So the potentials, the traffic, the revenue is in the north, not in the south, besides many other reasons. They have also a very bad experience apart from telecom. When they seized the central bank of Yemen and moved it to Aden. What are the outcomes now? Yemeni riyal value against USD in north areas is almost double or more than double its value there in the south, in the areas that are ruled by the so-called Hadi government. This is due to bad management in bad sector, and I'm sure that the same thing goes for communication sector. And this is the result of the absence of leadership. They are not there. They are controlling the government there by a remote control from Saudi Arabia, from hotels there. Mm-hmm. That is being dominated by external forces, by Saudi-led coalition. They are controlling them. They are dominating them. On the other side, the Sana'a leadership, Sana'a government, are fully independently ruling the country. They are putting the higher priority for the Yemeni citizen interest. So I think these late incentive strikes, raids to communication sector are the result of their failure to move the sector to Aden.
Well, Mr. Nizar, in case this aggression continues as is and we see more war crimes against civilian facilities like that of the telecommunication sector in Yemen, how do you think Sana'a will respond in case this aggression continues to target such civilian institutions?
Coalitions or aggression, they don't need excuses to bomb institutions or even civilians' facilities or households. They are practicing this, ma'am, from 2015, every single day. However, they are trying to create state of antipathy against Ansar Allah when they declaring that Ansar Allah are using those institutions to launch drones. Okay, I'm sure that you have seen a video that was revealed by the media of the Ansar Allah and the Sana'a government. Mm-hmm. It's showing clearly that they were not using any institutions. You can only see mountains, valleys to launch those drones. So it's only excuse to put pressure on Sana'a governorate inside the community of Yemen and outside. Mm-hmm. And they will fail. Sana'a will not stay still. They will target again and again.
Well, in hopes that the war on Yemen ends soon, for everyone, and all sorts of blockades are lifted. I want to thank you dearly and deeply, Engineer Nizar Al-Muayyad, head of the IT department at Sabafun Yemen, for being with us. You are so kind to give us your time and talk about this horrific war crime. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Israel's agents in Lebanese media.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Ministream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it was remarkable what was revealed by the Lebanese Al Manar TV channel, quoting security sources following the investigations with one of the agents of the Israeli entity who were recently arrested in terms of exploiting the profession of journalism to distort the facts with lies and deception. The main aim of that rogue journalist was to distort the image of Hezbollah and insinuate internal Lebanese divisions in order to undermine the resistance, while insisting on linking all the suffering of the Lebanese people to the alleged Iranian occupation of Lebanon. Al Manar TV channel had published a report that included what security sources had revealed about the details of the confessions of the journalist accused of collaborating with Israel, Muhammad Shu'aib, who was arrested at the end of last month. More in this following report.
For years, under the banner of freedom of expression, the Zionists were able to infiltrate newsrooms to dictate what their broadcasters say, editorial offices to formulate events in their own language, and news websites to narrate the analysis that suits them. To achieve all this, they had to recruit direct spies who assumed these tasks in return for financial amounts paid per the article they publish. These deals, which began to reveal tangible evidence with the arrest of the agent journalist Muhammad Shaib, were not hidden. The Zionist imprint was evident in every word written falsely, in every slander that was propagated, and in every provocation and abuse that was launched from specific press platforms and targeted the resistance and its environment. When leaked documents about the arrest of the recent spy networks were published in Lebanese media, it exposed the role of the Zionists in directly influencing the creation of slogans that target the resistance and incite the public against it. After Al-Akhbar newspaper published last week the news of the arrest of a journalist on charges of spying for Israel, the Lebanese public was able to recall the campaigns that were launched against the Lebanese resistance, which portrayed its environment as one that is always ready to accuse others of betrayal and treachery and that does not tolerate freedom of expression. Muhammad Shaib's name came out to the media. Leaks rolled and his confessions became public. His operative, Tom, asked him to write articles accusing Hezbollah of being behind the port explosion, articles targeting Hezbollah's Dr. Hamad Hassan during his tenure as health minister, and articles addressing issues related to Hezbollah's Qard al-Hassan Association in a provocative manner. The list of headlines he was asked to write about goes on, but we also discover that some articles were delivered to him well-written and all ready to be published. Tom then asks him to prepare reports on political issues that are the subject of internal disagreement and division, and to write these issues in the interest of the Persian Gulf countries, in language hostile to Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas, and in terms that indicate that Lebanon is occupied by Iran. Shaib was asked to publish on Al Kalima Online, Lebanon 24 News website, and the Voice of Lebanon radio website, and he was paid for each article between $50 and $75. Shaib was later asked to create a Lebanon Project group on Facebook to publish everything in favor of Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf states. He was earning $200 per month to operate this page. Sources indicated that this is only the tip of the iceberg of Shu'aib's confessions about what the Zionist enemy requested of him, media and politics-wise, to incite the public opinion against Hezbollah on the one hand and stir up internal strife on the other. What was remarkable is that the agent journalist Muhammad Shu'aib was praising the resistance on his Facebook page to cover up what he was doing.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, agent Muhammad Shu'aib's operative, known as Tom, asked him to prepare reports on political issues that are the subject of internal disagreement and division, while writing these issues in the interest of the Persian Gulf countries in a language that is hostile to Iran, Hezbollah and Hamas, and in terms that indicate as if Lebanon is occupied by Iran. That brings to mind at least five other journalists in Lebanon who follow the same pattern here. Are we looking at a complete network of agent journalists, or is this just a coincidence?
First of all, I would like to thank you for having me on your show. There is no such thing as a coincidence in the world of intelligence and the world of recruitment, especially if we look in depth and analyze the content of the intense media discourse that has appeared in Lebanon in recent times. Indeed, over the past 3 or 4 years, this discourse has been working and pressing in one direction, which is continuous accusations against Hezbollah, in a way that these accusations and this media narrative has evolved towards talking about an Iranian occupation and whatnot. These media narratives and this intense media pressure through traditional and modern media, especially social media, needs a full network of collaborators, implementers, and agents. We regret to say that there are journalists, colleagues, who are agents of Israeli occupation, at least the announced ones and those arrested by the Lebanese security services, who are known and work in this profession. But they are not the only ones in this line of treachery that is only logical. Flooding Lebanon with these false narratives and misleading stories that aim to besiege the resistance and its environment and demonize this environment with all its beliefs, ideas, culture, and even the simplest aspects of daily life, aiming at the great goal of destroying the environment, which leads to the destruction of the resistance. All of this needs an integrated network, as we mentioned before, that works on social media, traditional media, newspapers, magazines, and even in seminars and regular evenings in cafes and restaurants, in order to plant these ideas among the Lebanese public, to create a public opinion that is hostile to the resistance and its project in Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Hamza, what was interesting is that according to the investigation by the Lebanese security services, Tom, the operator of Shuaib, not only gave him titles and political topics to talk about, but he also assigned him the names of the appropriate personalities that he should go and interview to put that interview in each article. And we're talking about political and journalistic figures from what is known as March 14. That raises a lot of questions concerning the level of coordination between the Zionist entity and the political foes of Hezbollah inside of Lebanon. How do you think the resistance will deal with such a phenomenon?
It's not the first time that the resistance has faced such attacks by recruiting Israeli agents in all sectors. In the past, there were agents in some political parties, in some productive sectors, in telecommunications companies, and in many other sectors. This is not the first time the resistance has faced such an issue. Knowing that the resistance contributed to the arrest of a large number of Israeli agents inside Lebanon, as the resistance security was the main contributor to these arrests through its private security apparatus. With regard to how to react to such news, we are accustomed to the leadership of this resistance and the resistance in general to deal with these issues with a cool and calm mind, and it knows perfectly what is going on behind closed doors. The resistance has a very large data bank about political parties and certain personas, both internally and externally, that works to recruit agents and target the resistance in various fields, especially in the field of media. But the decision in the resistance today, with regard to its reaction to the recent arrests, is that the apparently normal context of events will remain, and there will be no tense or an emotional reaction to these pressures. But the series of exposing these agents to the public will continue, during which they will also expose the hostile narrative that the resistance, its environment, and its audience face. The agents were exposed and dismantled in front of public opinion, so that the same public opinion would know that all the narratives that come from such journalists, including the Iranian occupation and Hezbollah's control over the political, economic, and military decision in the country, and the other narratives that have worked to stereotype the general political atmosphere in Lebanon. One operations room is created, and many media professionals, activists, and influencers are responsible for marketing it, each in his own field of work. But there is a small remark about Muhammad Shuaib, that journalist who was arrested and whom your report mentioned at the beginning. Muhammad is one of the youngest agents, so to speak, and those who work in the superficial crust of this rugged system. There are more dangerous agents, if you are talking specifically about agents in the media sector. There are those who run large media outlets and have relations with important political parties and officials in the state, and parties inside and outside the state. They are the ones who take direct responsibility for publishing and broadcasting these narratives, false, misleading, fabricated, and hostile to the resistance and its environment. Today, we see in many talk shows, people and guests talk about normalization with the Israeli enemy in a very natural way, as if they were dealing with any other internal issue, even trying to raise this issue as if it was a controversial issue, like the issue of electricity, water, and elections in Lebanon. There are several personalities in Lebanon, especially among those who are influential in the artistic field, such as actors and singers, where this category of people and professions is teeming with those who deal in stereotyping this narrative and broadcasting it in the Lebanese society. They propagate the logic and the subject of normalization from the gateway that the Arabs have established normal relations with the Israeli enemy. The Arab media is now dealing with the Israeli file as if it were a normal file.
يتناولون مناحي الحياة في فلسطين المحتلة
بأريحية كبيرة. Mr. Hamza, that we will be approaching a parliamentary elections in Lebanon. I wanted to ask you about that, but we are out of time, unfortunately. But we will have more weeks to come. We will be talking about the influence or the possible influence of these traitors and agents of the Zionist entity, and how will that affect the elections in Lebanon. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Al-Khamsa, journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper, for joining us to talk about the agents of Israel in the Lebanese media, and thank you. See you soon.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Irreversible impacts of the climate crisis are getting locked in, and the window to prevent even more dire changes is getting smaller. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned in a new report. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Sharon Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading Irreversible Impacts on the Climate Are Getting Locked In, IPCC Warns. Stay tuned for more. Irreversible impacts of the climate crisis are getting locked in, and the window to prevent even more dire changes is getting smaller. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned in a new report. The report, prepared by hundreds of researchers around the world, finds that the Earth's temperature has already risen by 1.9 degrees Celsius and is on track to surpass the Paris Agreement's goal of limiting warming to under 1.5 degrees Celsius within the next few decades. Some impacts to ecosystems and the vulnerable regions are already permanent, and warming of 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees will only bring more damage. Half of the world's population is living with high vulnerability to the climate crisis, research has found, while half of the species assessed by the IPCC have already shifted to different habitats in order to survive. Changes that are arising from greenhouse gases are coming quicker than communities can adapt, and in some cases, adaptation mechanisms are furthering the crisis. Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, in a press conference said, "I have seen many scientific reports in my time, but nothing like this. Today's IPCC report is an atlas of human suffering and a damning indictment of failed climate leadership. With fact upon fact, this report reveals how people and the planet are getting clobbered by climate change. An apathy from political leaders and the continued use of fossil fuels are to blame," Guterres emphasized. He said, "Coal and other fossil fuels are choking humanity. Extreme weather events like wildfires, heat waves, and flooding are already affecting people. Heat waves in the Pacific Northwest killed hundreds last year. Meanwhile, millions of people in Asia and Africa are being displaced due to storms and floods. An increase of wildfires, tree mortality, and thawing permafrost are further increasing greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. Rising sea levels will rapidly increase displacement. Coastal populations, including those living in cities, are increasingly at risk of death or having to flee their homes. In the next decade, such resource loss could cause violent conflicts and mass migrants." Impacts to the water system are also dire for humans. Record heat and droughts are exposing millions to growing water and food scarcity issues across all continents. While food production challenges are resulting in increased malnutrition, especially for indigenous people and low-income communities, about half of the world's population already experienced severe water scarcity for some part of the year. These changes are having impacts on the global community's mental and physical health. Climate-related illnesses have increased along with the range of the diseases. Storms and floods are causing more occurrences of gastrointestinal diseases like cholera, while wildfires and other air-polluting events are causing more cardiovascular and respiratory diseases. One of the most striking conclusions in the report is that we are seeing adverse impacts being much more widespread and being much more negative than expected in prior reports, said Camille Parmesan, University of Texas at Austin ecologist and co-author of the report. The recent report is just one part of the IPCC's overall package on the impact of the climate crisis. The first part of the report detailing the physical elements of climate change was released last summer. The most recent installment lays out how these impacts affect humans and society. The report's authors warned that while some changes are locked in, further climate impacts and climate-related deaths aren't unavoidable. It's up to wealthy, powerful governments to make the change. But reporting has found that wealthy nations actively work to weaken the portion of the report specifically tailored for policymakers, according to Climate Home News. Some nations pushed for terms like losses and damages to replace with adverse impacts. Although the changes ultimately weren't included, the effort is reflective of world leaders' continued refusal to prevent climate disaster.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Vienna talks began in April. Now March has begun and they're still on. This ongoing eighth round ought to be concluded now, going by the rumors heard every now and then. If they're true, we may see a Vienna deal ready for the signing next week, meaning early March of 2020. But would that make a difference to Iran's image in Western media? No promising prospect even is painting a pretty picture of an Iranian foreign policy victory now. Western parties to the JCPOA and now the JCPOA revival talks have waged a media war on Iran as a scapegoat carrying all blame for the talks dragging on and maybe failing. But what are the facts on the ground? For some answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. The United States and its partners in the negotiations realize that if they don't come to terms with Iran soon, the JCPOA or nuclear deal will be rendered meaningless. As Iran has already succeeded in enriching uranium to 60% purity. So how Iran is the loser in the Vienna talks, it's hard to see. It's a messy media game board. But once the chips fall, there'll be no hiding who's won what. For a look through the chaos, I bring you three experts on this show to clarify. Mr. Golru is on the Parliamentary National Security Committee, and the National Security Council is supervising the Vienna talks. So we thought it worth a trek down to Parliament.
I'm not saying we're happy with how things are, but we're not dissatisfied either. Our nuclear capabilities have increased after the US withdrawal from the JCPOA. The Israelis who egged on Trump to exit the JCPOA in fact did us a favor. What the Islamic Republic of Iran has achieved in its nuclear program has been astonishing. If they don't carry out their obligations, Iran will continue down this path.
Enrichment to 60% purity is just days and weeks away from the 90% needed to make a bomb. Not that Iran wants a bomb. It was happily enriching uranium to under 5% purity. But the US pulled out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and Iran remained committed for a year until it started reversibly inching out of its nuclear commitments and started expanding its peaceful nuclear capabilities. The deal was signed in 2015 between Iran and the P5 plus one. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China and Germany. The idea was it would be a win-win deal, obligating Iran to limit its nuclear program in return for nuclear-related economic UN sanctions to be lifted off this country. Now that ship has sailed, with the UN sanctions gushing back as US sanctions. Regardless, what must the U.S. do now to come to a good agreement with Iran, be it the JCPOA or an adapted Vienna deal? Mr. Lasjerdi comments. He's a media man we visited at Khabar Online or Online News.
The first point is that the Americans left the JCPOA and have to pay the costs for their return. Iran and six world powers negotiated a deal in 2015 and had the world's eyes on them for a long while, and then a participant in the deal leaves it with no consequences whatsoever. Things have changed in the few years since the Americans withdrew from the deal. Iran has been facing tremendous pressures on its economy, trade, oil sales, and other areas. I believe the first thing to consider about the U.S. return to the JCPOA is that it should make reparations for the damages.
We do envision a straight return to the 2015 deal, a senior U.S. State Department official said. There will be very little to surprise you if we succeed. The requirements of the original agreement on Iran's nuclear program and on our sanctions are quite clear. But like I said, Western parties fear that ship will sail any day, which is why they set the informal deadline of end February. Mr. Olyayi is an expert who came to Press TV studios to share his thoughts on the matter. Let's hear him out.
Iran is going to enrich more and more every day. And they know that Iran may cross the breakout that they think that Iran is crossing the border, and for that reason always they are putting those deadlines for Iran, because this is one issue. And another issue, I think, which is more important, the sanctions are losing their effects in practice. When you have a very prolonged sanctions, the other party will comply with it little by little.
Western parties fear that Iran's continuing expansion in the quantity and quality of the fissile material it is producing and in other areas that give it the means to construct a nuclear weapon would make a return to the 2015 terms meaningless. Sounds like Iran has the heavier pressure lever, the greater leverage, as it has already demonstrated its ability within its rights by terms of the JCPOA. But looking at Western mainstream media, it wouldn't seem so. The purpose of the eighth round of the Vienna talks was to examine what the U.S. should do to return to the deal. But instead, the West has been busy playing media games to switch the culprit in the minds of readers and viewers.
Now, speaking about the deal, why are the negotiations taking so long? Why are they so intense and advancing this slowly? We are not to blame. Let me explain. One side of the talks is the content, which is concerned with how much of the sanctions will be lifted, what obligations do the sides have, and what mechanism to use to implement the obligations. But the most important point is the guarantees for the deal's implementation. Even if you have a great deal but no mechanism to implement it, it practically means that all those rounds of talks have been for nothing. We don't see any initiative from the Europeans and the Western side over guarantees for the implementation of the obligations, especially in the economic aspect.
Real News has it. The negotiation process, although slow, is positive. Never mind that, the Western side is now on the track set by Iran. But Western media is portraying Iran as a loser to both domestic and international public opinion. What are they saying? That the negotiation process has been slow because of Iran's maximum demands. In the same breath, however, they make it look like a tactic on Iran's part when they say Iran is taking its time with the talks to advance its nuclear program. Then they conclude, these conditions have depleted the JCPOA of non-proliferation capacity and made the continuation of negotiations meaningless. And so they have to threaten it, would seem, that if negotiations fail, other options are on the table to contain Iran.
I believe what the Americans and Israelis are doing is somehow understandable. When you stick to your principles and state your demands firmly, the other side has to have a real argument why they can't provide guarantees or lift sanctions, or they have to start playing games. I believe Iran's demands aren't beyond the scope of the JCPOA. They are not demands that Americans can't meet. If they resort to threats and such escalatory rhetoric, it's partly for public relations purposes. They can't or don't want to meet the demands, or are looking for more concessions from our side. In such circumstances, they resort to issuing threats, including military action.
But when talks are progressing, they'll say, Iran tried to gain concessions by putting pressure on the West with maximum demands, demands so high that it had to retreat from them. If talks fail or come to a stalemate, Iran will be the culprit, and if they succeed, it will be the loser. Whereas in reality, Iran has held a Herculean fort. It's been under 40 years of international sanctions and 4 years of the toughest ever U.S. sanctions. But even with all that hurled at it, it has managed to accelerate its peaceful nuclear industry within the framework of safeguards and prevent a collapse of its economy and other faculties.
They thought that after having, as they called it, the crippling sanction, the sanctions which any country in the world didn't experience before, they thought that by this sort of sanctions, Iran will come back to the negotiation table, and there they can impose whatever they want. But everything in this period, after Donald Trump went out of this agreement, everything showed that the United States didn't reach whatever they have expected to reach in this period. And when you fail to reach the goal that you had before, I think the policy needs to be changed.
For a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more to be said, but only after a quick look at other media outlets. And here's how their words look in actual print. Arab News reads, progress toward Iran nuclear deal, but issues remain, says U.S. official. Negotiators have made significant progress in the last week or so on an agreement to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, but very tough issues remain, a senior U.S. State Department official has said. There's been significant progress over the last week or two. We have significantly narrowed the areas that still need to be resolved. And so, in that sense, there has been progress that has been moving toward a potential deal, he told reporters. The U.S. official also said that there has not been any deal reached in separate negotiations about the release of 4 U.S. citizens whom the U.S. believes have been wrongfully detained by Iran. So we are in a better position than we have been, but at the same time, it's important to note that very serious issues remain. We've got a piece from Tasnim News that says, West to blame if Vienna talks on JCPOA revival fail, Iran's FM says. That's Hossein Amir Abdollahian, Iran's foreign minister, who said the West, especially the U.S., will be to blame if the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal fail, stressing that Tehran has always demonstrated it is prepared to sign a good deal. We are very optimistic about the results of the Vienna talks, and that's because the administration of the new president of Iran, Dr. Ebrahim Raisi, has the serious will to achieve a good deal with the other side. Amir Abdullahian said in an interview with CNN on the sidelines of the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany. Now we are at a very sensitive time, and the other side should be realistic. And if the talks fail, we believe that it is the Americans and the other side that are responsible for it, he added. The Islamic Republic of Iran has shown its seriousness and has shown that it really wants the deal to be done, and we have been trying to reach the deal. Our Mehr News headline goes, Vienna agreement not to be weaker than 2015 deal, Ulyanov says. In a tweet, Russia's permanent representative to the Vienna-based international organizations, Mikhail Ulyanov, wrote, in anticipation of revival of the JCPOA, some analysts claim that the deal will be weaker. Not true. We will see JCPOA in its original form, which by definition cannot be weaker than it was in 2015. Ulyanov's tweet came as Naftali Bennett, the Zionist prime minister, claimed that it is possible to reach an agreement in Vienna in the future. But this agreement will be weaker than the 2015 nuclear agreement. Vienna talks have reached a sensitive stage in recent weeks that requires Washington to make political decisions. And if Iran sees the seriousness of the United States and European countries, a good agreement is within reach. That'll be it for the news section today. But do stay tuned. Regardless of whether there's going to be losers and who those might be, there has been significant progress in the last week or two of negotiations. But the small technical details left for last are apparently the toughest, especially as the West finds itself with a desperate shortage of time for dealing with them. Now, Iran does have some red lines of its own in coming to terms with the U.S., which might not help with speed. But again, it's in keeping with terms of the agreement and fairness. What are those red lines?
Any new deal can be a second or third JCPOA, which is not accepted by Iran anymore, which they are going to include some other matters rather than the nuclear issue. The second JCPOA, like Iran's defensive program, like Iran's influence in the region, these kind of things, I think, are beside those red lines, which is drawn by actually the people who are in charge of these matters in Iran.
Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian reckons that if the Western side should seek to adopt a realistic view of what is going on at the negotiating table in Vienna, we would be able to reach the stage of a final agreement within a couple of hours.
The Americans have taken a tough stance and are looking for winning excessive concessions. President Biden wants to get political gains from the talks, but is following in the footsteps of Donald Trump. He doesn't want to change the policies or remove the sanctions. What we mean by removing sanctions is quite clear. According to Article 7 of the Parliament's bill to remove the sanctions, all bans, including those related to the JCPOA, the nuclear program, human rights, terrorism and others, must be removed. Imagine we clinch the deal based on the current draft agreement. The Americans must guarantee its implementation, but they refuse to do so. This is unacceptable.
America has been pushing for direct talks with Iran over past weeks, but Iran expects some proof of good faith before conceding to this. Say the lifting of some sanctions or releasing $10 billion of this country's frozen assets in foreign banks. Looking at America's foreign policy and media warfare, however, one wonders why the evasive superpower of the far West returned to the negotiating table in the first place to talk on Iran's expectations as well.
One point to mention is the change in the ruling team in the U.S. In my view, it appears that compared to the Republicans, Democrats prefer diplomacy over war and conflict. The second issue is Trump's personality himself, which was key in different matters, including the JCPOA. The third point, in my opinion, is that under Donald Trump, the world had reached its boiling point for tensions, both in our region and in relation to Iraq, Syria, and others, and outside the region, including with North Korea. The new team in Washington has arrived at the conclusion that it can't continue with such tensions in the air.
Airbrushing Iran's negotiating tactics as a failed attempt won't whitewash America's own foreign policy miscalculations. Sanctions so severe as to cut off a whole sector of another country's national economy has only backfired. It can unwantedly cause states to double down on their former behavior. Between 2017 and end 2020, sanctions cut Iran's oil exports by more than 80%. This resulted in a cash shortfall of some $150 billion for Iran's government. But this country continued to increase its stockpile of enriched uranium, install faster centrifuges, and upgrade the quality of its enrichment. And now it is Iran that is refusing the U.S. direct talks thus far.
I think after these years of resistance, Iran has resisted a long time. I think the negotiation team, our team there, they shouldn't be pressed. They shouldn't be affected by such a thing, by those medias, because they know that, they should know, I think they know it well. They are not at the time that the Western parties being able to press them that much. They are not at that situation. They want this deal more than Iran.
The people of the world and the public opinion should know that the psychological warfare they've launched to paint Iran as the culprit is void and unacceptable. We believe that the mechanism of accountability cited in international law, which stipulates anyone who violates its obligations must be subject to it, must be implemented against the Europeans and the US, because they did not honor their commitments.
Individually dealing with an Iran is a handful enough, and the U.S. has picked up more than one handful at a time. It imposed sanctions on Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and Russia, and now it's facing a united front of U.S. foes, as sanctioned countries have been uniting to find ways to break U.S. pressure and hegemony.
You see, it's the nature of the international system. When you're under sanction by powerful countries, you're automatically going into an alliance with similar nations. Currently, Iran, Russia, and China are under Western sanctions. You can add other countries, including Syria, to this circle. It's only natural that in order to break the chains of the international system and neutralize the pressures the US and powerful nations apply using the sanctions, the countries come together and cooperate to stand up to the other side's bullying. Collaborations among countries under the sanctions, including Iran, Russia, and China, are natural responses to the United States' excessive demands.
The United States imposed sanctions on Venezuela in 2019. Since, that country's state shipping firm and some shipping agencies reportedly began ignoring protocols for checking tanker identity as part of a smokescreen which Iran helped develop so that Venezuela's oil exports would continue. That's to say they carried out business under fake identity. But they carried out business with and via Iranians and Russians. Venezuela both traded with Iran and borrowed its tactics. Iran and allies, this alliance of sanctioned countries, is but a sign U.S. foreign policy hasn't quite been working. But Iran's chief negotiator to the Vienna talks, Bagheri Kani, like delegates from other parties, returned home for consultation Wednesday, February the 23rd, before reconvening with P4+1 countries and U.S. representatives in Vienna. I'd say it's a sign Iran also is taking the talk seriously, in spite of U.S. stunts still on the loose. To be fair, however, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday, February the 4th, signed several sanctions waivers related to the JCPOA. Because, as a senior U.S. State Department official said, absent this sanctions waiver, detailed technical discussions with third parties regarding disposition of stockpiles and other activities of non-proliferation value cannot take place.
Over the few months of talks, the Iranian parliament, especially the National Security Commission, has closely followed the talks. It has monitored the developments in numerous sessions with top officials from the foreign ministry, including the esteemed minister and top negotiator Mr. Bagheri Kani. The parliament has opinions regarding the matter. The National Security Commission will hold a meeting with the foreign minister to discuss the draft agreement in detail and investigate to what extent it secures our national interests and the interest of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Russia has been negotiating with the West, especially the US, on behalf of Iran, also to gain concessions for itself from the West. This is while it is involved in conflict with Ukraine and its energy sector, therefore faces tighter US and NATO members' restrictions. Now, Iran is also a major producer of both oil and gas, the export of which is currently limited by sanctions. Lifting sanctions on Iran would allow this country back into global markets, particularly in Europe, which has been depriving itself of Iranian oil and gas for years and now is depriving itself of Russian oil and gas. The Ukraine crisis is observed to have unsettled already tight global energy markets, leading to increased prices in Europe and America. Now, an increase in Iranian production would both ease tensions in oil markets and lower prices to the 80s. This would also appease American businesses and consumers. Robert McNally was a senior national security and economic advisor in the George W. Bush administration. He estimated that Iranian oil production